Start your day the right way by taking charge of your physical and mental fitness.
It's important to know your numbers. They determine if your blood pressure is high or low, your cholesterol balance, even your blood sugar level, heart rate, and much more.
Get tested by visiting your doctor, clinic, or stop by at any health center closest to you.
Take control today. This message is from Doctors on Air with Dr. Pamela.
This is Doctors on Air with Dr. Pamela.
Good morning. Today we're going to be talking about irritable bowel syndrome. It sounds big, but it's something that we'll break down into very digestible chunks. Good morning, Dr. Chinenye and Annie. It's a real pleasure to have both of you here on the program. We're discussing the irritable bowel syndrome, so it's important we bring some awareness. So if I start off with you, Dr. Chinenye, can you break down what irritable bowel syndrome is and why should we as Nigerians be concerned about it? Is it something that affects us?
Thank you, Dr. Pamela. Happy to be here discussing irritable bowel syndrome. Okay, so irritable bowel syndrome, so it's a condition or a disorder that affects the digestive system. So the digestive system, basically your stomach and intestines, right? We refer to it as a functional disorder. And what that means is there's no actual damage to your digestive system, like the tissues of your digestive system, right? So, but there's a functional problem where your digestive system is not functioning the way that it normally should. Okay? So that's the a simple way to put it. Yeah.
Now, in terms of, you know, what it is, I know for a long time, a lot of people thought it was a phantom diagnosis. It was a dustbin diagnosis. It's a diagnosis that people make when it doesn't really, you know, nothing fits into really any category. And, you know, do we actually have like a name for it? You know how many conditions have a name in our native language? Can you say it's Jedi Jedi? Can you say it's, you know, what? How can you classify, you know, this irritable bowel syndrome a bit more so that people can connect with what it is we're talking about today?
Yeah, so quite frankly, it would be difficult to give it a name in our native language, you know, but what we find is, so we have like a criteria that we use to make a diagnosis for it. So the person would have abdominal pain, recurrent abdominal pain. In fact, in the criteria, at least once every week for the last 3 months. And then there are other, so with this abdominal pain, one of these other two symptoms, number one, a change in the bowel movement. So the person, for example, used to go to toilet every day, once a day. Now they find that there's a change in that. The change could be constipation, where they're finding it now difficult to go to toilet, or diarrhea, where they now have more frequent visits to the toilet, to stool. So that's one. So abdominal pain plus either this change in frequency of bowel movement or a change in the stool consistency. Okay, so it could be that the stools are harder or softer. So you either have that alteration in the frequency or the consistency. Okay, so yes. Yeah.
Now, how about bloating and gas? How does that feature? Because a lot of people have problems with bloating and gas. It's like a precursor to irritable bowel syndrome. Is this something totally different? Because some people sort of wrap it up in there. How does that feature?
So it does feature, actually. Now, these are, we refer to them as additional symptoms. So you find that people who have these other, who meet the criteria that I've mentioned earlier, then sometimes would have bloating. And sometimes it will start with bloating, a bit of bloating, excess gas. Sometimes there'll be mucus in the stool. So you have these symptoms that are somewhat non-specific that can fit into any other thing. You know, but when someone comes and we suspect irritable bowel syndrome, by the time we get this history and maybe examine, there are certain other symptoms that if we find, we will know that this is not irritable bowel syndrome. So for example, if there's blood in the stool or the person is losing weight, or there's some anemia, maybe you do a blood test and their blood levels are low, You know, so there are certain things that when we see, or they have a family history of, let's say, cancer of the stomach or any part of the digestive system. So those are like alarm symptoms that would tell us that this is not likely to be irritable bowel syndrome. But other things like bloating, sometimes nausea, you know, the changes like I've talked about in the bowel habit and the frequency and the consistency or the appearance of the stool. So when those ones are there, but you don't have the alarm symptoms, then we're thinking more towards irritable bowel syndrome.
Now, at what age does this start? This irritable bowel syndrome. And the reason why I'm asking you is this. Some of these symptoms you're talking about, children have them. And then adults just say, oh, this child doesn't want to go to school. The child is lazy. The child is just difficult. You know, and these are some of the things that people have been labeled with. And then later on in life, they find out they actually have a syndrome. And really and truly, you know, particularly in our own environment where, you know, you just beat the children and send them to school. You know, you just say, these children have been punished unnecessarily for some of those symptoms, you know. So can you shed some light on that area?
Okay, so I'll start with answering about the age, right? Generally speaking, actually, irritable bowel syndrome tends to start in the 20s, early 20s, mid 20s. In fact, if you find the onset, like the person just starts to have these symptoms in the middle age or older ages, you need to be a bit more suspicious and look for something else. Now, in children, however, remember that I said the criteria is not just the pain. Most times in children, you have this abdominal pain, but there's no change in the bowel movement. So sometimes the doctor has to tease out to be sure. So if the child is taken to the hospital, we're able to tease out that information to be sure that the child is not just malingering, maybe there's something else, you know. But when there is a change, so if this pain comes along with a change in the frequency and the appearance of the stool, those two, one of those two factors have to be there. So it's really not just abdominal pain. And many times when the person goes to the bathroom and moves bowel, there's also a change. So sometimes there's a relief of that pain. So those patterns have to be there. Yeah. So it's not just, you know, pain, which in most children, when we suspect children, is usually just the pain and maybe when it's time for school. And yeah, so that happens, but it's not always the case.
Yeah. So how about, so there are no like precursors. So you can't say, oh, you know what, it's very interesting that this person has developed irritable bowel syndrome in their 20s, but actually they had some of these, you know, very vague symptoms when they were children that nobody really picked up on. Are there any kind of precursors like that that people should be looking out for?
Yeah, so it's difficult to tell because, I mean, if it's a child now, do we want to make that diagnosis at this point? You know, if it's an adult, if we trace it back to childhood, for example, it may not necessarily change how we're going to manage the person going forward, right? But there are other precursors, other things we look out for. Someone who comes and in their 20s, they start having the symptoms. And maybe, yes, they give the history, they had something similar in childhood. We take that. But even when they didn't have anything in childhood, there are other precursors we look out for. Stress is a major factor. Stress is a major, yeah, it's a major precursor or, you know, a major trigger, so to say, for the symptoms being worsened in people. And sometimes even the diet, what we eat, how we eat. So those are factors that are involved. The kind of drinks we take, alcohol, coffee. So there are several factors that may then trigger or even worsen the symptoms, so to say.
Now, what about things like lactose intolerance, gluten intolerance? Because a lot of people, particularly, well, those of us of African descent, you know, have a lot of lactose intolerance in general. But how do you differentiate between those intolerances and irritable bowel syndrome?
Yeah, so sometimes it's difficult to differentiate, right? Because someone who has irritable bowel syndrome, for example, we would want you to avoid lactose-containing foods. Okay, but there are other things that would also trigger you. For most people who are lactose intolerant, they would notice that the changes come, the pain, the diarrhea, or whatever else they have, would come, bloating and so on, would come when they take lactose-containing foods. But for people with irritable bowel syndrome, it will not be only lactose-containing foods. So that's the difference. Yeah, so for people with gluten sensitivity, for example, they would notice that it's when they take gluten-containing foods that they tend to have symptoms. So that's where you can, that's the way you can differentiate it.
Okay, no, that's all very interesting. So we've talked about symptoms, we've talked about triggers, but can you talk about the cause of the disease? Because sometimes you hear about things like flares, no flares, you know, and how does a person, for example, understand what kind of, perhaps what kind of type of irritable bowel syndrome they have and the kind of course of history?
Yeah. Okay. So there are different types of irritable bowel syndrome. Let me start with that. So we have diarrhea predominant, meaning that, remember that I said you have the pain and then you can have a change. So the change can be diarrhea or can be constipation. So if it's diarrhea predominant, we call it IBSD. That's irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea. When it's constipation predominant, it's IBSC. In some people, you can actually have a mix of both. So we call that IBSM. So it's like a mixed picture. And then we will have unclassified, where you have irritable bowel syndrome that it's difficult to classify because sometimes they have bouts of diarrhea, they have bouts of constipation, neither here nor there. You know, so we have the unclassified type as well. Now, regarding flares and exacerbations, yes, when someone has irritable bowel syndrome, that's IBS. There are times when, for example, if the person is able to manage themselves, diet, stress and all, which we'll probably get to, they may have less symptoms during that period. And sometimes something triggers it, some stress at work or just being Lagos traffic and all the Lagos stress. Yeah, so triggers something. And at that point, you have an exacerbation or what we would call a flare. But I know that when people hear flares, we're thinking more of IBD, and that's completely different. So I wouldn't want to use the word flares here. Yeah, so I'll just say exacerbation of the symptoms can occur here and there. Yeah.
No, I mean, this is all really quite fascinating, but how common is it in Nigeria, really?
No, there have actually been studies, research has actually been done on irritable bowel syndrome in Nigeria, right? So there was a research that was done comparing. Now, what we've found so far is that it varies in geographical locations. There was one that was done comparing northern Nigeria and southern Nigeria, and it was more predominant in northern Nigeria and more predominant in among females in northern Nigeria, right? But so prevalence, you know, different researchers, different geographical locations has been as far as wide as 8% to about 45%. But generally speaking, I would say it's around 30% in Nigeria where the diagnosis is rightly made.
That's very common, like, you know, far more common than one would have expected.
Yeah.
Hey, so I think that we should just really, as Nigerians, we need to be more aware of it. But there's no issue, I mean, in terms of when you make a diagnosis, how accepting are people of the condition?
So the thing is, the way we make a diagnosis, we try to make sure that we exclude other possible digestive system disorders, right? You don't just come into the clinic and by the time I ask you one or two questions. So I would like to be sure that it's not a thyroid problem, which can cause similar symptoms, you know, or gluten sensitivity, or, you know, there are so many other factors that can cause similar symptoms. So by the time we ask you questions, examine you, do a couple of tests, we'll then be able to make the proper diagnosis. And yes, people are accepting when they've seen, they are confident that you have done all you can to be sure that this is the problem and to rule out other problems.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Doctors on Air with Dr. Pamela.
That's been a very interesting first half, Dr. Chinenye. So, you know, we've talked about different areas. We haven't talked about treatment yet. How do we start off with the treatment?
Okay, so there are actually various factors involved in treatment. However, diet is a key, is one of the most important things regarding treatment. Okay?
Yes. Yeah. We're very fortunate to have a dietitian here. So, yeah. Annie, can you tell us what you know about irritable bowel syndrome and how you help to manage it with your patients?
So with diet and IBS, it is a game of survival of the fittest. And I'll explain what I mean. So one thing I've come across in practice is that most times, no two patients have the same triggers for IBS. They might present with the same symptoms that Dr. Chinenye has referred to, diarrhea, bloating, the cramping, the gas, and all of that. But plantain might trigger one person and not trigger the other. So there is a need for a lot of individualized dietary management in IBS or any other gastrointestinal disorder for that matter. Of course, there are general guidelines as to how these things can be managed, but with each patient, there is a need for a specific doubling down on what they're eating just to be sure. And you have to do like control experiments to make sure that this particular food is not triggering any type of discomfort. If it is, let's take it out and replace with something else. So I just wanted to put that out there. Now, for like specific guidelines as to dietary management. It's not don't eat processed foods. It's don't eat ultra processed foods, right? That's the ones with excessive sugars, refined sugars. That's where the concern actually is, because every food that we eat has been processed in some shape or form, right? So you have things like that. Don't eat ultra processed foods. Try and be responsible for your meal preparation by yourself. That way you can account for what is going in, the amount of spices, the amount of carbs, proteins. You're in control. They're more aware of what they're consuming, right? So off the top of my head, those are the first two guidelines. We would also say that you need to keep a food diary of what you're eating and how it makes you feel. So for instance, you have a meal like rice, vegetable, and meat. So you want to check how you feel 2 hours after the meal. You want to check how you feel 4 hours after the meal. You want to check how you feel just before your next meal. If you don't feel any discomfort, it means that that is a meal that can stay in your day-to-day routine. If you feel any sort of way, you might want to take out that combo for that period and then like do separate meals. So if you had rice, plantain, and meat, you might want to try plantain and other meals and see if it still irritates your system. Then you can say, okay, maybe the issue is with plantain. Let me completely remove plantain from my diet. So it's a very expensive, quote
very enough, specific, and also very specific punishment.
Very expensive.
General things that you can talk about, like maybe eating high fiber, or you know, just some sort of general rules for a person who might be listening that hasn't yet, you know, is starting that journey and obviously still needs to see a dietitian.
Most definitely. So yeah, eating fiber can be a way, but I've come across patients who have discomfort when they eat fiber. So that's why I said that it's a very specific thing. It's an individual thing. So yes, eating fiber, especially eating oats, can be a way to go about it. We will obviously tell you not to have any type of added sugars or fizzy drinks. So no sodas, no coffee, things that would generally irritate the system or make you uncomfortable, right? Those things are, they're not supposed to be in your diet. You want to exercise. You don't want to eat a lot of spicy or fatty foods, right? And ultra processed foods, I've already said that as well. You also want to learn how to chew your food, and that is not a culture we have in Nigeria. Courtesy of swallow. We swallow our meals. It's the truth. But yeah, we need to learn, especially with people treating IBS, you need to learn how to chew your food, because digestion starts in the mouth. So you need to learn how to chew your food properly. You're not rushing your meals. You're also not skipping your meals for fear of, oh, if I eat now, how am I going to feel in the next 2 hours and I'm going to be on the road? So that's like a common practice among people managing IBS, wanting to skip meals or not eat regularly. We also encourage like exercise 30 to 45 minutes on a daily basis or every other day, as in the purview of what Lagos traffic can allow you to do. Yeah, so these are like general guidelines that we would normally talk about, but then it's very specific and individualized.
Thank you so much. So Dr. Chinenye, going back to you, can you tell us, that's been fabulous hearing from Annie.
So somebody who is struggling with IBS diarrhea, the IBS D type, for example, will give you medications to help bulk in the stool and reduce stool frequency. But somebody who is struggling with IBS constipation will give you stool softeners, laxatives, and so on. So really, it's still on a case-by-case basis, but we don't have like a drug that you say, oh, this is the drug treatment for IBS. You get to, it depends on what type of or how it's manifests in that person.
Now, we've heard of things like probiotics or peppermint oil and so on, which obviously peppermint has always been known to help digestion. And, you know, are there any alternative things that people do that are good or not good? And then one of the questions that we heard earlier was the question about what about things that people eat at night? There's a lot of things that do's or don'ts, rather, particularly culturally, as to what we eat at night. How does that play a role?
Yeah, so regarding alternatives, peppermint oil, like you said, is actually one of the recommended alternatives. Okay, and yes, it is good. It is helpful for the digestive system. Some come in capsules, the peppermint oil. You have peppermint oil capsules like that, that people actually take and they help. You know, but like the dietitian emphasized, many times what works for one person, what helps one person may not help the other. We even go as far as psychotherapy for some people, because anxiety, depression, stress, these are factors that play out in people who have IBS. So sometimes we even recommend psychotherapy or psychological therapy for people who have IBS. Regarding eating at night, now, I mean, we don't, for GI disorders, we generally don't recommend eating at night. I mean, you've had a meal. When you eat during the day, you're more likely to be moving about, you know, your digestive system is more likely to be more active. By the time you eat late in the night and then you go to bed, everything slows down. So sometimes your symptoms may be worsened depending on what we're dealing with, but your symptoms may be worsened when you have late night meals. So we don't recommend that. Okay, so yeah.
Ami, we don't have much time left. In fact, it's almost time to sort of wrap up. And we have just about 2 minutes left of the program. But in your last words for our listeners, I just want to find out, is there any way anybody can prevent themselves from getting IBS?
I'd say no. Because, I mean, it's something that even the etiology is still being investigated. So it's difficult to say that this is what you would do to get IBS or to not have IBS. You know, so it's difficult to say. But we generally recommend good physical activity, less stress, good sleep, healthy, balanced diet. Those things help.
Annie, do you have any last words for our listeners?
As much as you can, the healthy lifestyle is something that you should adopt. I mean, less added sugars. You want to be more in control and more conscious of the things that you're putting into your system. So if it's to take cooking classes or just experimenting with your food, and trying to exercise, which might not necessarily mean going to the gym, but taking walks or dancing. I mean, we're very danceable people. We like music in this part of the world. So like a 20-minute dance here and there doesn't really hurt anybody. So yeah, as much as you can, maintain your stress levels, especially if you live in Lagos.
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you. Really appreciate it.
Doctors on Air with Dr. Pamela.